It's Chatter on Books, and if you think this introduction is boring, you try writing the copy. I'm Jamie McIntyre. Here's Tori Clark.
Welcome back to everybody. Hope you're doing well. Hope you're staying healthy. Hope you had a good Halloween. And in just a little bit, we are going to be talking to Susan Orlean, who is a best-selling author many times over, a revered New Yorker author and writer, and author of this great book on animals. I don't think I have so looked forward to a show as much as I have this one, because everyone knows my love for animals, and her stories are remarkable. And this will continue the achieving our goal of getting David Aldridge to get a dog. So we'll be on that track. We got David Aldridge. We got Professor Mike Crowley from Denison coming in from flyover country. How are you guys doing? Halloween? Halloween scale of zero to 10.
People don't come here. We had one kid last night. They don't come to our block for
why?
Some reason.
That's a beautiful block. Why?
I know, and it's well lit. And I don't know. We have, but that, as I always say every year, more candy for us.
Yeah, exactly. Mike, Halloween? Yes, no, maybe.
Yeah. We were in the middle of it. We had a Cookie Monster in our house and ghost Spider-Man, which is a new cartoon that my daughter. She is the girl Spider-Man on the girl spider.
Nice. So. We live on such a main drag here in the DMV. And somebody years ago told the embassies, I think a newsletter or something goes out to the embassies every year that says, big street, good parking, take your children there who do not understand Halloween. And so Pandemic, obviously last year we didn't have it. So this year is kind of a big year, the return of 300, 350, 400 kids. The best part with the kids that come in from the embassies, they're a little confused. Their parents, who also dress up. It's not just the kids dressed in cute outfits. The parents dress up. And the parents, the embassy parents, as we call them, always help themselves to candy. I'm going to get some, too, of course. But we had a lovely night. Okay.
They take handfuls. So they just, like, stick their big claws in there and grab.
So we adopted the Al Roker theme a long time ago, which is we're full-size candy bar kids, right? Full-size. So we're all right. Very popular. And people are allowed to come back. Up until a certain point, they can only take one. And then you have to start guessing how many more kids are we going to have.
Yeah.
We got some to get rid of. So then if the kids are cute, you give them two. But sure. it's usually one. And kids always cheat. One kid last night, this obnoxious young lady, blocked me out. The candy is in a casket, which is a longer story. And they have to reach into the casket to get the candy. And this one girl blocked me out so I couldn't see her and her friend taking more than one.
Jeez.
It's okay. It was 8:30.
Like they were going for a rebound. Like
exactly.
They were Moses Malone boxing them.
Zach Randolph.
Exactly. Okay. I've got here a couple pop-ups and then I've got quizzes, which just makes me so happy. I love giving other people quizzes. Thanks to Ron Charles, the Washington Post, we learned again that Toni Morrison's book, Beloved, is in the news again. And it's in politics again. And we won't even mention the race because it's too scary to even think of. But politicians are once again, certain kinds of politicians are once again denouncing Beloved as something terrible and kids shouldn't be reading it in school. And legislation is introduced, fortunately often not passed, but legislation is introduced saying these kinds of books should not be read by K-12 kids. Mm-hmm. So David, have you read Beloved?
Yes.
What'd you think?
It's a great book, you know.
Done it, right?
And it's perfectly part of the canon of books that people other than cis white males write, you know, like, so what are we talking about here?
Right.
And, you know, this comes up all the time. And as you mentioned in politics, when AstroTurf groups hire these people to pretend to be concerned parents to flood school board meetings and intimidate school board officials to alter their curriculum because it sells politically. This has nothing to do with Toni Morrison. They found this phrase, critical race theory, that no one can define. They're using that to scare people into thinking, oh my God, we may actually teach kids about the actual history of this country. Oh, well, they couldn't possibly handle that. You know, so,
Mike, love, not love. Does anybody on campus at Denison read it?
Oh yeah, we have an African-American literature professor. She teaches it every semester. It's a great book. You gotta read it. You're gonna study English. You gotta read it. I mean, I mean, that's a scary book. I should have picked that from a scary book last week. I mean, that's a freaky, scary book in all the best ways.
A scary book in all the best ways based on a true story. So yeah. I remember reading, so it was 1987, I think, when that book came out. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. I was busy and I was working really hard and wasn't doing a lot of reading, but that comes across the radar screen and I read it. And I think that may have been when I don't know, finally said, wow, there was stuff going on I really need to pay attention to. And when Oprah decides to make the movie, I said, this is one of the many reasons I love Oprah, right? Because that was not a popular thing to do at the time.
Sure.
But I remember thinking it was just so extraordinary. And over the last 5-10 years, I guess, even before we started the show, every few years you hear somebody trying to ban the book. And every time that happens, I find myself going, damn it, where's my copy? I look around, I can't find, I buy another copy. Yeah. So I think every time these knuckleheads, which is my nice word for a really bad word, tries to ban it, I think it's just good for the book. So that kind of makes me happy. Now,
that experience you had, that's the whole point of reading a book like that.
Right.
It's outside of your experience. And it opens something up inside of you that is very human and real and powerful. Yeah. And, you know, it's like David said, it's just a proxy for some political, it's not really about the book, right? They're just trying to glom onto something that they can use as a weapon. And it's frustrating because it's a beautiful, magnificent book. So
Ron Charles of the Washington Post is getting fired up about this, which makes me so happy.
Yeah.
This makes me so happy when he just can't, he's a brilliant writer. He really should write a book. He told me recently in an email, never, ever, ever, but he gets fired up about this, which I love. Okay. From the sublime to the ridiculous, David.
Yeah.
Curses. Because it's that, you know, beloved, a little bit about a curse.
Yes.
I think the Washington football team has a curse.
They have a curse.
Yes, it does.
No.
It has just a bad owner. Is that kind of
yes,
the same thing?
That's all this.
Bad management's not a curse.
This happens to me all the time. And when I'm writing and I get stuck and I go, don't overthink this, David. Just write what it is. This is what it is. Don't get cute with it. Just write. And that's what this is. They have a terrible owner. Who makes terrible decisions, and they're always, there's a phrase I could use that I don't want to use because it's a family podcast and I won't use it, but they step on themselves all the time it's almost always self-inflicted, and they make terrible decisions because they don't have the first clue about building a great organization.
It's too bad. And meanwhile, the Wizards looking good. We're optimistic.
They're doing better.
Yes. A lot of baling twine and bubblegum. We're going to keep the Caps going.
The Caps are fine.
They're fine, but there's a little bit of age to the team, and I love
them. They're old, but this is like, they're like the Nats in 2019. I mean, they're old, but they have some young guys. I am so frustrated. I don't know nearly enough about hockey to be able to write intelligently about it. And I feel bad because I want to appreciate what Ovechkin's doing other than just he scores a lot of goals. I mean, I know what he's doing is unbelievable, and I want to express that unbelievableness to people, you know, because it's amazing, and I want to take it for granted.
This is my favorite. It usually is at about 6:09 p.m. Mike's experienced this before when we go into chatter on sports. One of the things I've always said about hockey, David, and the players, when I, you know, all the different sports have different rules about how injuries have to be reported, right?
Yeah,
hockey is among the most vague.
Lower body injury, right?
And they don't want to let their opponents know, because then, of course, that's what their opponent's going to go after.
Yeah.
I have been told, I've not seen this myself, but I'm happy to be an honest witness, that if you saw the bodies of these players when they're in the regular season, week by week by week, it's just horrific, right?
Yeah, sure.
Just the bruises and everything, right? So you can only imagine Ovechkin, late 30s, has been doing this for a long, long time.
Correct.
So the fact that he's still doing it as well as he's doing it is extraordinary.
That's what I'm talking about, is the remarkable consistency to me is what I'm in awe of, the fact that he's just there every year. It's not that he's, you know, it would be the equivalent of, I think he's the equivalent of Hank Aaron. What I mean by that is that if you look at Hank Aaron's stats in baseball, he never had a season where he hit 59, 60, 61 home runs. He just hit 40 every year for like 27 years, you know, like a crazy number. And that's what Ovechkin does. He just scores 44 goals every year, you know, like it's crazy.
For the first time ever, I think Caps fans have started to go, oh, maybe Gretzky. It's a long way to go. I think it's 150 goals behind, but they could just keep pushing him out there. Yeah. And his teammates love him so much.
Yeah.
They want him to do this.
I think they do. Yeah.
All right, so that's done.
And Susan is packing up because she's had
enough.
Susan's
packing up. Said, yeah.
Okay. What is the show that I signed up to do?
I had no idea it was a hockey show.
Neither did I.
Well, you just heard everything I know about hockey, so now we can move on.
There's a very serious story in hockey right now, which my husband, Dave, and he's a bigger fan than I am, as you know, of hockey, feels is undercover. But anyways, another topic. Okay, this is the first pop quiz for Mike and David. This was a final Jeopardy question the other day. So if you watch Jeopardy, maybe you heard it. These two men both died in Boston in the mid-20th century. Each won 4 Pulitzers, 1 for poetry and 1 for drama.
Wow.
When did they die?
Mid-20th century.
Century in Boston.
Both died in Boston. Each won 4 Pulitzers.
Okay. 1 for poetry and 1 for?
For drama.
For drama. Okay.
Wow. I'm not even going to guess.
Oh, come on.
I have no idea.
I guessed these correctly. Robert Frost for the poetry.
Okay.
And Eugene
I thought you meant they both wanted poetry and drama.
No.
That's what I thought too. See, it was the question was worded poorly. So
then blame Jeopardy. They've got a lot of problems with Jeopardy these days, so you can blame them. My favorite thing is I'm pretty sure that Eugene O'Neill is the only American playwright to win the Nobel for literature. David, who recently won the Nobel for literature that we deeply resent?
Oh, Dylan, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay.
So I have seen.
Deeply resent.
Another
I
life
was contending that year, and then that bum.
I was worried it was
Louise Glick for a minute. I was like, what? Why are we mad at Louise Glick?
So in another life, I was an usher, and I love theater. I've seen Cats more than any person alive. And we had Long Day's Journey and Tonight.
Wow.
And it was a great cast. It was Jack Lemmon, Blythe Danner, and a young Kevin Spacey. It was a great cast.
Wow.
That's the most depressing play I've ever watched in my life. Oh my God, what a depressing play that was. But it was fantastic. It was great. But
I always wonder what happens to the psyche of the actors and actresses who work in shows like that day in, day out, 8 times a week. Yeah. Okay. Only thing more depressing than that is famous people who wrote poetry. Are you ready for this? Poetry, challenging enough. So this person, you have to guess who it was, died in 1937. Only in the last few years have smart people like Professor Crowley, uncovered poems written by this person. And this person, very famous for something else. But here's an excerpt, which should give it away as to who this person is. Even the watchful purple hills that hold the lake could not see so well as I, the stain of evening creeping from its heart, nor the round yellow eyes of the hamlet growing filmy with mist.
Wow.
1937, kind of a famous thing.
I got nothing, Mike.
Okay.
Okay. We're talking about hockey again?
Yeah. Amelia Earhart. I got to give credit to Christine Negroni of the Washington Post. She wrote the foreword to this particular book. It's called Beyond Haiku, Women Pilots Who Wrote Poetry. And Amelia Earhart, turns out, wrote poetry. She didn't want it out there. She kind of hid it away, and it got shoved in some box somewhere.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it just kind of started coming out. Purdue has a collection of these things. And evidently, it's not bad as poetry goes.
It's not bad. No, that's kind of cool. The movie, I forget who played her, but it was wonderful. She was great.
Yeah, it was good.
And
Amelia Earhart, did she land on the island or did she crash somewhere, David?
I've heard all the theories that she was captured by the Japanese, and I'm guessing she probably crashed.
I think she landed.
Do you?
I thought I saw something a few years ago where someone unearthed some photo that would have been post crash/landing of her, and I don't know.
Yeah,
right next to the Bigfoot photo. It's right next.
Well,
to
I don't know.
I don't
know. I don't. I think Ovechkin was there, but I don't think Bigfoot was there.
So. Okay,
he's just there. Ovechkin's everywhere.
He's there. He's been doing it forever.
Okay, we've got three more. This writer
You're never really taxing Susan's patience here by
first one. I said 6:20. I've got 4 minutes. This you can buzz in whenever you want. This writer never set foot in Ireland after he turned 30, but he's most famous for writing about Dublin.
Robert Burns.
That'd be Scotland.
I'm sorry. Joyce, right?
What's that?
What'd you never set foot in Dublin, is that what you said?
After he was 30 years old.
Joyce?
Yeah. Yay. Okay.
I'm shocked. The academic.
Thank God I knew one.
Mike's winning. 1-0.
They're going to let me teach class tomorrow.
Exactly. That's some surprise to you.
There are hints in these descriptions. Okay. This American writer never learned to drive.
That's it?
That's it. He never learned to drive.
This American writer never learned to drive. Jack Kerouac.
David, go! 1-1. Excellent. On the Road about the Beat Generation. Excellent. Sure. Okay. I'm going to read this correctly. So this British female author's writing, her writing and how she did work was in a particular kind of space. That's kind of relevant. Her husband described her space as, quote, old nibs, bits of string, used matches, rusty paper clips, crumpled envelopes, broken cigarette holders, etc.
Virginia Woolf.
Yay! Mike wins 2-1.
Mike wins 2-1. And a
good
shocker.
Good job.
A shocker.
Okay.
Everyone was like, why had that happen?
It was a little bit of a struggle, David, though. It was a little bit of a struggle.
No, but he pulled it out in the end. That's
he did try. He did. Okay. No, competitions. Susan, you're still with? You're still willing to talk to us?
Absolutely. I'm more good. Willing than ever, actually.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us.
I'm so delighted. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so that's David Aldrich and that's Mike Crowley. They are wonderful people. Yeah. Mike actually knows something about literature. That's why we include him occasionally.
Maybe.
So Mike, you said you're going to get all geeked out this week. What's your first geek out?
I think we have to talk about the Twitter incident last year, right? I mean, that has to come up at some point.
Yes.
But I teach a sports writing class, and I teach Life Swell in your piece from Outside Magazine. I just love that piece so much. And I'm just kind of curious if you can talk a little, for folks that haven't read it recently or don't know it, you went to Hawaii and tracked down these surfer girls. It's kind of like a little band of girls that were totally into surfing. And I'm just kind of curious how you found the story and then what particular challenges you had in writing that story. Cause it's such a beautiful narrative and such a great job of like following one character, but also exposing all the other characters too. So.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, that story had an interesting origin. Outside Magazine had come to me and said, would you like to do a story about these surf girls in Hawaii? And I said, yeah, that sounds fun. That sounds great. And I headed over to Hawaii. When I got there, I called. They had given me a list. And I can't explain to you why I went and then called them as opposed to calling them and then going. But I went and began reaching out to each of these girls. And one after another, they would say, yeah, no, I'm not into surfing anymore. And then I'd call the next one and she'd say, yeah, no, I'm much more into rollerblading. And and I thought, oh my God, I have blown it. And I called my editor and I said, look, I'm really sorry that I've spent all this money coming to Hawaii. And she said, well, just give it a day or two, just see what happens. So there was one left on my list. And I hadn't called her because she was a boogie boarder. And I thought, well, that's not the same as surfing. And then I thought, well, I'll just call her. She was a little bit older than the other girls. And I started pouring out my heart to her. And I said, you know, here I am. I came all this way to do this story. And none of these girls are surfing anymore. And she said, well, those are the wrong girls. I don't know who gave you those names. Those are girls who surf for 6 weeks because it was cool. The real surfing girls are these girls in Hana. And she said, I'll introduce you. And it was a totally lucky thing because if it hadn't been for Gloria, I wouldn't have connected with them. I probably would have limped back home and begged for mercy from the magazine. And instead, these were the girls. They were really hardcore. They were the ones who had been doing it for a long time. They weren't just surfing because it was trendy. It's always challenging to write about kids. They are both, you know, you owe them a certain caretaking that you might not with an adult. And that's something that, you know, you have to work around, just the issues of the ethics of writing about people who are underage. But they were incredibly open. The real challenge for me is they wanted me to go surfing with them. And I thought, under no circumstances am I going surfing with you, 15-year-old, super athletic, Hawaii born and bred. No.
But how flattering that they thought you could do it. That's spectacular.
Oh, it was great. And, you know, in fact, it probably would have been fun to give it a try. Although I have to say, in Hawaii, they are surfing on huge waves.
Yeah.
So it wasn't for a beginner.
Right.
But I think that the challenge in writing about young people is that feeling of they're so open, and yet you as an adult need to be a little mindful of their vulnerability. And you know, there was nothing I was looking to rip the lid off, but you can get very close to kids, and in a way adults are much more careful and much more savvy about what it means to be written about. So it brings up some interesting ethical questions that are not hard to solve, but they need to be solved.
Mike, why do you like teaching the story? What is it you like about it?
Well, you know, I thought it was interesting what you said about, I think that's interesting what you said about kids. We had Wright Thompson into class to talk last semester too. And he was talking about when you do like a college athlete profile, there's only three steps. Like there's not a lot of places to go with the college athlete profile. It's either like a redemption piece or the future is limitless kind of piece. You know, like there's only two ways that goes. And he said, because I don't like writing those, because there's nowhere to go. So what I liked about your piece, as you were talking, it reminded me, like, there's a weightiness to the way they're invested in surfing because they are so young and everything matters so much when you're younger. Like when you're older in college, you start to know a few things, or at least you can be nonchalant or try to act nonchalant, but they're just earnest. And that sort of gave it a weightiness, I thought, to the piece, which I really like. I like just, you know, structurally, there's some really interesting structural things you do in that piece, the way you introduce characters, you know, not to get too in the weeds on the structure of it, but the way you introduce characters, the way you create a narrative arc with the story too. But I just liked how it never felt light. It felt this was really important to them. And you need to respect that as a reader. Like, these aren't little girls that are surfing. This is their life. This is a culture. And it was a way to sort of see them individually, but to see a culture of an island and of a place. And I thought that's what sort of transcends it from like just a sort of regular profile into something that is sort of timeless and you can sort of still teach 20 years later.
Nice.
Well, certainly I'm incredibly flattered by that. So thank you. And I did feel there was a profound sense of they were in that moment where all possibilities still seemed available to them. They all could have these dreams very much intact about all of them going on to being pro surfers and live forever in this sort of idyllic way, that the realities of the rather harsh world had not yet invaded, but they weren't 5 years old. I mean, they were capable young women, but it was still possible for them to fully and unselfconsciously be invested in this. So there was a lot of poignancy writing about it as an adult and feeling like, you know, none or few of you will really live that life. I know because I'm an adult, and I know that the group of you are not all going to end up as professional surfers living this idyllic life, but their hearts were still really in it. And, you know, so there was a part of me that felt kind of pained for them and yet also really awed by the purity of their enthusiasm.
That's the subtext of the piece, is like, this is kind of probably their horizon, like, but you don't say that. And that sort of runs through the piece. And I was just thinking what you're talking about too, like, it's a piece that only could have been written in that time, because like Instagram would totally destroy like that kind of culture now, right? Because they were kind of isolated because of where they were in Hawaii too, right? Mm. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even driving there was, it was such a pocket that was, not a lot of tourists go there because the drive is notoriously difficult. And so, unlike a lot of the rest of Hawaii and certainly a lot of Maui, it felt still like a culture that was intact from an earlier time. And it was pre-social media. And I agree with you. It would have really changed it. And these girls were amazing and beautiful and athletic and strong and not the least bit self-conscious about or even aware of how extraordinary they were and how beautiful they were. And they weren't living in a world where girls are posing in bikinis at age 13 on Instagram. So it still had this feeling of being unaffected by a lot of the rest of the world.
Nice. David, do you approach, you must approach the high school athlete differently than you approach even the freshman
of course,
protective,
because you know they say things and they believe things that you know aren't true, that you know that they will learn are not true, but you can't be the professional scold and say, you know, Johnny said this, which is completely ridiculous. I mean, who wants to have that role in their life? You know what I mean? Like, nobody wants to do. So you have to I think, as Susie pointed out, like you take a certain ownership of, I have to be careful. These are kids.
Yeah.
And that's why I never write, when I write about college athletes, I never assign blame to them if their team loses the game.
Yeah.
Because they're kids. They're not getting paid to do this. Right. They're doing it because they really like playing, you know?
We probably talked about this when we had, was it Jesse Washington on, wrote about John Thompson. How did you feel about John Thompson, who did not like his younger players talking to the media at all?
I understood it. I disagree with it because I covered them and I wanted to talk to the young freshman players, but I understood why he did it because of that very thing, because young people say things and believe things that really aren't fully formed yet. You know, they just aren't.
Yeah.
And if you put that out there and assign that to them, they can be scrutinized because of that. Because as we all know, journalism tends to be kind of a two-dimensional, not a three-dimensional thing. Yeah. It's very hard to make it three-dimensional. And certainly in a 24-inch story or a 700-word story, it's impossible to make it three-dimensional. And so you don't want them to kind of be associated with this thing that they said when they were 18 years old. Like, who would? My God, can you? I mean, they could fill libraries with the dumb things I said and believed when I was 18, you know? So
I don't think a day goes by that I don't think to myself and say out loud, thank God at least the first several decades of my life went on without social media. Thank God. Right?
Sure.
Okay, Susan, can we talk about your fabulous book on animals?
Thank you.
For the last couple of weeks, I have just driven people crazy saying, oh my God, do you want to know something about racing pigeons? Oh my God, do you want to hear about this crazy lady in New Jersey with these? Mm-hmm. I have just driven people insane. But I have to take you back because we like the backstory on our authors here. Did you really write a story when you were five about a nearsighted pigeon?
David and I
could not tie our shoes. Mike Crowley's smart. He might have been writing when he was five, but David, you and I were trying to figure out how to tie our shoes.
Well, I will say, and I put it in the book, a little bit of a disclaimer that sounds very young, but that is the family legend that I wrote Herbert the Nearsighted Pigeon when I was five. And I did learn to read and write early.
Wow, why? Who got you to read and write early?
My sister taught me, my older sister, and she used the newspaper to teach me how to read.
This is the difference between Susan's upbringing and mine. My older sister's taught me how to do shots and a few other things.
That's also useful. That's very useful.
It's well used. I don't know about useful, but well used.
Yeah, exactly. And so I learned early, and I learned not reading children's books, but reading the newspaper, and which is weird and funny when I think about it. But
what did you like to read about in the newspaper?
Well, I probably didn't understand much of what I was reading. I loved reading the classifieds, and when you think about it, the classifieds are written in a very simple way. And if you're going to teach a kid to read, that's probably a good part of the newspaper to use.
Sure.
Because the concepts are not complicated.
Uh-huh.
But
right?
I loved writing little stories. I wrote little journals about my family's vacations and travel. And then I began writing stories. And this was the one that allegedly was the earliest.
Nice. And I've seen a few interviews and you've said you always wanted to be a writer. Was it this a romantic notion? Who were your inspirations?
I just felt from the beginning that reading and writing was magic. It seemed like a magic trick. You could look at these squiggly lines on a piece of paper and have an adventure, feel you had visited someplace, felt like you had met someone, gone into another period in history. And the magic of it was so powerful to me that I wanted to make that magic really early on. And I didn't know any writers when I was a kid. It's not that neither of my parents were in the profession. Nobody, I grew up in Cleveland. People around me were lawyers and business people. And, it wasn't that I grew up in an environment with lots of writers.
Sure.
But I wanted to make that magic from the earliest I can remember.
And how did you, and Mike, jump in here. How did you learn how to write? Because one of the most amazing things about this book by Susan Orlean on animals, every word, every sentence, every paragraph has meaning. And you may not care about tigers or rabbits or racing pigeons, although I'm now addicted to racing pigeons. And I think Netflix should do a series on racing pigeons the way they did for Formula One, because that'll transform the industry. But how did you learn how to write so well?
Probably the short answer is by reading great writers.
Such as?
I would say when I was very young, I would read, back when I was a kid, Life magazine was a really good magazine. And it wrote long slice of life features, and I would read those and think they weren't always about famous people. They were often just a very documentary piece about something that had merit. And I will never forget when I was quite young reading a story that was about the day in the life of a small town doctor. And how the morning began, he delivered a baby, he told someone they had cancer, he patched up someone's, scraped knee. And I think that the idea that this man's life, which was not a celebrated life, he was a small town doctor, what that was worthy of examining. And I loved the idea of that, of telling that kind of story. Then I began reading you know, I was lucky enough to sort of be birthed into the world of new journalism. And I remember reading Tom Wolfe when I was in high school and feeling like, that's what I want to do. I knew that I wouldn't write like Tom Wolfe, but the idea that writing about real life could be as animated and exciting and dramatic and funny and weird as fiction was, I mean, I was hooked instantly. And then I began reading John McPhee and Joan Didion and Joseph Mitchell.
John McPhee, I tell everybody, if you don't read anything else, read John McPhee.
Yeah.
And if you have any doubts about the power of writing, his story about the Pine Barrens in New Jersey, it's incredible. Who cares about the Pine Barrens in New Jersey? And you read that story and go, oh my God, his story about Bill Bradley. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
You don't have to care about Bill Bradley or basketball, but you read that story and go, that's the power of writing.
Yeah. And I think then when I got a subscription to the New Yorker when I was in college, I thought, oh, there is a place that really reveres this kind of writing and that I can aspire to. That you don't have to be a celebrity or rich and famous to warrant being written about, and that the story of your life can be utterly fascinating.
Yeah.
So it was something, you know, really the tradition of the New Yorker was very influential for me. And I think the best way to learn how to write is to imitate the people who you think are good.
Mike Crowley, are you smiling? Do you agree?
Oh, yeah. What's the Elliott line is amateurs imitate, artists steal, you know, like that.
Yeah. It's really funny. And it's true. And when I've said to people, just sit there with the good stuff next to you and look at it. And, you know, obviously you are writing about something else. So you never are going to worry that you're literally lifting things. But you study it and see the way it got built and use it as a model. And then eventually you can sort of push that model aside and do it the way you want to do it. But it's certainly, that's the way, it's an apprenticeship, and it's an apprenticeship with a book and or with a stack of books that you admire and that you study. And I have a couple of books that I always have on my desk when I'm writing. And when I'm stuck, I just flip through them. And at this point, it's almost just a nervous habit that I just flip through them. But I used to look at them all the time thinking, how do you introduce a new character? I don't know how you do that. Well, wait, let me look at this Joan Didion piece.
Nice.
And see how she did it.
Okay, I could just sit here for hours and just flip through animal after animal because it makes me so happy. But I'm going to let David and Mike pick the animal. David, because I know you're about to buy a dog. You're about to have a dog in your house. But pick an animal, because then I'm going to tee Susan up to tell the story from the book on animals, which is fabulous. You can pick a dog, you can pick tiger or rabbits. Which one do you want her to do first?
Chickens.
Okay.
I love the chickens.
All right, Susan, backyard chickens.
I had no idea that chickens are so hunted by everything. I didn't know that.
Oh, my God.
I thought, well, they got claws. They can defend themselves, right?
No. They are really ill-equipped. They don't run fast. They can barely fly. They're very vulnerable, and everybody likes chicken. You know, it is the other white meat, and everything from foxes to hawks to dogs to raccoons. You know, the big slaughter of my particular flock was a raccoon.
Yeah.
But I'd lost chickens to pretty much every other animal. Fisher cats. I mean, the fact that they've survived this long is kind of amazing, because they really are not set up well. And roosters are, it's helpful if you have a rooster.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's not going to do it.
The raccoon in your book was a mass murderer. I think
yes.
I think he
was a psychopath. He was a psychopath.
Raccoon Kava, mass murderer. Okay,
yeah, he didn't eat everything.
On the cover of your fabulous book, also on right there for News Channel 8, mm-hmm. is that one of your, which one of those? Is that?
That's not one of my chickens, although I had one. I think that's a silver-laced Wyandotte.
That's what I thought.
Breed. And I had one who, and they're absolutely beautiful. But this was a picture that when we were looking for a great chicken for the cover, we came across that wonderful. Picture.
We briefly had chickens here in Chevy Chase, Maryland. It started out with a sixth grade science experiment to see how different heat would affect eggs hatching, which seemed to be a failure until one of the 12 eggs actually hatched. And so he was called Lucky. And Lucky was living in an ice bucket in our kitchen. And I told our kids, put the screen on top of the ice bucket all the time. Leave this, because Lucky, the chickens, as you know, Susan, grow very quickly, very quickly. And somebody didn't leave the screen on. And we came home and our dog, Jack, who's a wonderful dog, had eaten Lucky.
No!
Very sad.
Yeah.
Not for Jack. Right? Jack is probably pretty happy.
Yeah. Yeah, and then literally, we come in the house, Jack's looking very guilty. There was a little feather sticking out of his mouth. He looked very guilty, which then caused our daughter, Devin, maybe she was the one that left the screen off the ice bucket, felt really sadly. She and I are at the farm store one day, and they were selling, it was springtime, and they were selling six chicks for a dollar. They're in these big tubs. I'm sure you've been in a place like this, Susan. Big tubs, six chicks for a dollar. And Devin says, we should get one for Colin, her older brother, for his birthday, April, because he's so sad about losing Lucky. And I thought, he's not so sad about losing Lucky. But anyhow, okay, we'll buy one. I go to the cash register and said, we would like one chick. And the woman says, no, it's six.
You're not allowed.
For a dollar. And I said, well, we don't want six. We want one. I'll pay you a dollar if we want one. Nope, you're taking six. So we came home with six. They were Rhode Island Reds. They grow so fast. But Susan, you have to talk about this because, and it was a crazy time in our lives, three young kids, none of whom appreciated anything I did for them. And when I came out every morning on the porch, David's been on the porch, the chickens were happy to see me.
Yeah.
And they were appreciative and they liked the little bird feed and they liked the water I gave them. There was something very appreciative about chickens, right?
Well, I think that there's something incredibly satisfying about a relationship with livestock. And it's very different from the pets who live in your house who, you know, that's a different relationship. And you love them and they love you. But the relationship with livestock, you feel this enormous sense of stewardship that they really rely on you. And that's the bond that you make with them, that you will take care of them and they will do their job for you.
Yeah.
And it's a really, I loved having chickens and I loved taking care of them. And I always felt it was so pure. Yeah. I came out with their food. They were happy. I felt content and they'd lay eggs and, you know, it just felt like this wonderful quid pro quo that, there was a great harmony in it and really a lot of satisfaction and weirdly different from having a dog or cat in your house.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I agree.
You know, it's a different thing that first of all, they don't have a job. They're just kind of, you know, hanging out. It's like having a teenager. And
but again, you know, unlike the teenager, they're appreciative of the food and water you give them.
Right. But I loved having chickens and I miss them very much. And they were a lot of fun to write about.
Okay. Well, continuing on animals. Okay, Mike, dog, tiger, or rabbit?
Tiger, for sure.
Tiger. Okay. Susan, lay it on us. The lady in New Jersey, probably not far from the Pine Barrens, with 23 tigers.
Yes. I had read a little news report that noted that a tiger was seen walking through the center of Jackson Township, New Jersey, which is a suburban area.
Yeah.
And what caught my attention was that no one would admit it was their tiger. And I thought, what kind of situation is it where you have this, you know, literally a lightning bolt from heaven And nobody is admitting that it's their tiger. And moreover, the realization that there were a lot of tigers in Jackson Township, New Jersey, and that they are not, in case you're wondering, native to New Jersey. So in the course of trying to determine who was the owner of this loose tiger, it came to light that there was a woman in the town who had 27 tigers. Oh. She had acquired them over the years. She had let them breed. She had permits for four or five of them, even though she shouldn't have ever had permits for any.
Any.
Yeah. She claimed that they were for educational purposes, but they weren't. She never did anything with them educationally. And then over the years, she just began acquiring them. My first thought was, I say that so casually, she would acquire tigers. How do you acquire a tiger? To my eternal horror, I realized that it's really very easy to get a tiger.
It's kind of sad how easy it is to get a tiger.
Oh, it's horrible. Yeah. I mean, and it was really shocking to me because, you know, I don't troll the internet looking for exotic animals, but it takes 1 second to find exotic animals for sale on the internet. I mean, the internet has actually made it worse. It used right. to be that you'd have to go to Missouri or Texas or a yeah. state that had very loose laws about exotic animals, but now it's actually very even easier. And the story led me into her particular case, which was very complicated. It also branched out into being a story about animal hoarding, because there was no question she was an animal hoarder. But it also kind of swept in the whole issue of why are there tigers for sale on the internet? And you won't like the answer. And the answer is because good zoos, the best zoos, breed lots and lots of animals because people love baby animals. Mm-hmm. And if anybody spends a minute doing the math, they would realize that these zoos that are constantly announcing with pride that they have baby animals at some point don't have room to keep housing all of these animals. And when animals get older, they're not as appealing to mm-hmm. visitors. So there's unfortunately a gray market for what is known as surplus animals. Mm-hmm. And they end up on the internet, they end up in substandard zoos, they end up on hunting ranches. So it was a story that took me into a lot of, besides being about the specific case, which was fascinating. I mean, this woman was so wily and she had fought off the New Jersey state for years and years.
Yeah.
You know, she just kept getting continuances and changing lawyers and, you know, over and over and over again, managed to keep delaying the case. But there was a bigger story, right. And a really important story about, number one, this public health issue of animal hoarding and how we really don't have a good way of dealing with it. And secondly, this issue of all of these animals being bred, and tigers breed very easily in captivity.
That was fascinating. I had no idea.
Yeah,
Do you know that story that happened here outside Columbus, Ohio, 10 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wrote a fiction story about that, but
yeah, I mean, he was a hoarder, and you know what happens with this was the fact that I found the most amazing of any fact. And that is that the recidivism among animal hoarders is 100%. Every instance where someone has their animals taken away, they just get new animals.
Yeah.
And so you're not accomplishing really anything by taking the animals away, I mean, you're not ending that person's hoarding problem because it really is a mental health problem.
Yeah, right.
And the fact that it's easy to get more animals, I mean, certainly easy to hoard dogs and cats. One of the people who works in this animal hoarding consortium told me that he once dealt with a woman who hoarded beavers.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, whoa, that's intense. But animal hoarding is a real thing. And every time it happens, everybody freaks out because it's horrible and there's nowhere to actually send the animals. And I think in the case of the story in Columbus, this guy had run afoul of the law because he was running an illegal animal sanctuary, supposedly, but basically he was a hoarder. And so his revenge was he let them all loose.
Okay. So one of the things we are running out of time rapidly here. One of the things that's so stunning about this book, Susan, you're writing is my heart always goes for the animals. It just always does. I go, wow, how could you do that? And I don't care how crazy you are. How can you hoard animals? Because they end up being mistreated and unhealthy and terrible things happen to them. But you have such respect and sympathy, empathy and sympathy for these people. How do you maintain that? You clearly love animals. You clearly do. How do you maintain that with people who do these kinds of things to and with animals? Is that the journalist in you that says I've got to maintain some separation?
Yeah. Yes. I think that you cannot be a journalist if you don't have some ability to be an observer. And it doesn't mean that the piece has to be entirely objective. I think anyone reading the story about the tiger lady can tell quite clearly how I feel, but I think that it is essential that I tell the story as thoroughly as I can. And that I believe so strongly in the idea that we're all very opinionated, but you need to earn your right to have an opinion. And in order to earn it, you need to be willing to learn about the subject that you have an opinion about. And so my feeling, I never went into that story thinking I would come out saying, well, I think it's a good idea to keep tigers in suburban New Jersey. But I felt that I was obligated to try to learn the story. Yeah. And try to tell the story. And the state screwed up, for sure.
Absolutely.
And enabled her to some degree. But you have to, I think if you're going to be a writer of nonfiction, you have to really love learning, even about things that are painful.
Absolutely.
And you need to be really committed to the idea that your readers also need to learn.
Yes. And I could just go on for hours because the whole issue of Keiko the whale, who didn't want to live in the wild, you really gave a really 360 degree look at how complex that issue is. Rabbits. I was fascinated by the story about the rabbits and the virus. And I'm not sure when you really researched that story, but the comparisons to what's going on now with COVID are horrifying.
That was a COVID era story. And woo! I think that what drew me to it was learning very offhandedly about this virulent, super contagious virus that was roaring through the rabbit world and that had originated in China. And I thought, wait,
right.
What?
Yeah.
And
the parallels were pretty scary. And there are variants and attempts to, you know, the vaccination, but there's hesitancy about the vaccination.
Yeah.
I'm calling people and texting going, you've got to read this. This is amazing.
Uh-huh. Well, there are anti-vaxxers in the rabbit community. Yes. And there was hesitance on the part of the U.S. government to admit that this disease was here. which was, I thought, wow, we are doing it again. And this is in the case of rabbits. There was this resistance to acknowledging that this highly contagious disease was here and spreading really rapidly. And as you might imagine, all it takes is one veterinary clinic to have the virus around, and it just spreads and spreads and spreads. And it's in the case of this disease, what's really frightening is it's crossed over into wild rabbits. Normally, domestic rabbits and wild rabbits don't have the same diseases, which I had no idea that wild rabbits and domestic rabbits are actually not the same species. Mm-hmm. They are distinct and different. And they don't always share diseases. And in this case, this disease has mutated and crossed into the wild population. Well, to me, it was like a horror story, but with rabbits playing the people. And, you know, so this was right in the middle of COVID. And it couldn't have been more on point.
You could have substituted people for rabbits through the whole story. And it would have held up just fine during COVID. Okay, let me get, we could talk about the whales. We could talk about the racing pigeons. I'm in love with racing pigeons now. We could talk about dogs, Biff the dog. David, Mike, you're thinking about a new career. The top dog handlers get, Susan, is it $300 to $400 a day at the big dog shows?
Yes, and I'm sure the price probably has gone up.
Gone up, there we go. These, so it's another career, Mike. But let me ask you this, to get you out on the book. What is it that you think animals tell us about ourselves? Because you tell these incredible stories. You learn so much about what's going on with these different kinds of animals. But a lot of what you write about is people's interaction with them. And you're clearly an animal lover. So what is it that you think we learn from them or we get out of the relationship with them?
I think our most basic humanity is played out in the context of animals. And I'm not saying you need to be an animal lover to be a fully realized human, but the empathy for animals and the appreciation that we are one of many species inhabiting the planet is a pretty fundamental perspective that you need to have in order to sort of see us in the grand scheme of things. And I think that there is almost every human emotion gets projected onto animals and onto the way we relate to them and the way we sort of muddle through the question of what is nature, what's wildness, what's domesticity, what's natural, what's unnatural. And I feel that our world and our sort of awareness of the animal world is growing as opposed to diminishing.
Yeah.
You know, we're living more closely with animals now in many ways than we might have been 100 years ago. And COVID's a perfect example. I mean, if this is a disease that came to us from the animal world, we know that's true of HIV/AIDS. We know that's true of Ebola, you know, we are inhabiting the same earth. So there's a kind of perspective that comes with appreciating that we aren't the uber creature. We are one of many creatures on this planet. So there's a kind of humility, I think, that you come away with when you think about the animal world.
Oh, I agree completely. The older I get, the more I think, just because a lot of animals, most animals don't communicate the way we do, it doesn't mean they aren't capable of intense communication and remarkable empathy and reasoning. And I know the smart people and scientists are actually figuring out things about their brains, but I just think there is a lot going on in there that we don't pay a lot of attention to. And if you do, it's pretty remarkable. So David or Mike, are you ready to get dogs now? Or rabbits.
I can't have animals around me. I'm allergic to everything.
That's just a lame excuse. They're hypoallergenic.
Yes, there are hypoallergenic dogs. But,
yes.
argument
and the hypoallergenic rabbits.
Breathing community. Breathe around animals without problems. Those of us who can't have a problem.
Well, there are hairless cats, and they're really, really ugly. They're so ugly, but they want you to love them.
They're beautiful inside, Mike.
I want a Mexican hairless.
No, no way. I got these kids. No, that's enough. I can't.
Yep, exactly.
Oh, no, it's great. It's great. As my friend Jeanette Black used to say, and I've completely stolen, and in my next life, instead of having kids, I'm going to have dogs because they're always happy to see you and they're easier to train.
Correct. Oh, 100%.
Well, that's true.
100%.
All right. All right. We're going to skip 60 seconds more because this has been so fabulous. I don't want to step on it. Let me do a little housekeeping and thank everybody. So download us in all the usual places, write a review on Apple iTunes, because that mean guy who called us leftist racist, right, David?
Again, just tell us what race we're against. I'm just curious. I'm not even mad. I'm just curious.
Me too. Actually, we're encouraging him. If he's listening, and clearly he does, write another review. We'd like to know more. Check out Podcast DC, produced here in town by WTOP. They're awesome. Lots of local talent. We are back next week with Toby Harnden, who is the author of First Casualty, the untold story of the CIA mission to avenge 9/11. I do not know Toby. He reached out to me a few weeks ago. I checked with some friends of mine who should know, and they said he's the real deal. He knows what he's talking about, so that should be good. And Susan, thank you so much for being with us. Just a delight. Awesome. Everyone should get on animals. We're reaching the holiday season. It's a great gift. It is a great gift for anyone. Professor Mike, thank you. David, love you, honey. Lauren, thank you for taking care of us. Everybody out there, thank you for listening. Stay well, stay healthy, and we'll see you next week.